back in the 1990s, when I was planting a church in California, a lot of young couples started coming to the church, and Liz and I really hit off with this one couple in particular. You know, it's the kind of thing where you get along with the man and the woman, because sometimes, you know, you like the man, but the woman's not for you, or vice, you know what I'm talking about? Yeah, so we both hit it off with both of them, so, you know, it was great. So we'll call them Ronnie and Stacy, right? We did everything together. I mean, even, remember they tell you, don't go on vacation with your friends? You know, you've heard this, it's not in the Bible, but, you know, and but we vacation with them, dinners, cookouts, game nights. I mean, we did everything with them. And we were a little older than they were. They were behind us several years. And so they had, you know, marriage issues of newlyweds blending their lives together. And so we were there to mentor them. Plus, I was their pastor. And so we really got to know them. One night, I was sitting in the car with my friend. He told me, he said, you know, my wife, I'm really having a hard time with her because she just goes crazy. And I'm looking at her, I don't know what she looks like. And I'm like, she goes crazy? And he said, oh, yeah, she goes nuts. And he said, you haven't seen it. She hasn't shown it to you guys. But trust me, she does. And I don't want to do when she does this. And I said, well, that's terrible. I mean, because he said, I can't talk to her or anything. And he said, I call it the wild monkey. That's what he said. And I'm looking at her thinking, I just can't process this at all. Well, I found out about the wild monkey. So did my wife. One day I did a wedding, remember Ronnie and Stacy were with us. And so my friend was doing the photography as a side gig to make money, because that's what you do when you're newly married, right? You want to survive. And so he's doing a side gig, doing photography. So he's doing the wedding. I'm doing the service. So we had to hang around afterward. And so we turned Liz loose to go over to the another facility where the sit-down dinner was. And just, you know, be with the church people and hang out over there. We'll get there eventually. And so he took pictures and everything. And eventually we made our way over there. And when we made our way over there, we were late. And everybody was already, you know, at their seats, at the tables. And wasn't assigned seating. And so Liz just arbitrarily picked a table. And sat down, and then church people see her sitting there by herself, and they're like, can we sit with you? And she's like, sure. So pretty soon, all the seats around Liz are populated, and she saved one for me. And then we showed up. And so I didn't pay attention to what Stacy did, but she walked over to the table where Liz was, and basically that's when the wild monkey came out. Where's my seat? Well, the church people sat down. What do you mean? You didn't save me a seat. I'm your best friend. You should save me a seat. She went into a verbal tirade of F-bombs. It was unbelievable. Unbelievable. Unconscionable. And it was very uncomfortable. Anything Liz said to her wouldn't console her. She's screaming. She's yelling. And we're at a wedding. And Liz is like, we do everything together. I mean, why can't you just go sit somewhere else? So Liz eventually got up and went into the women's restroom, and Stacy followed her. Because remember, she was the wild monkey. And she went in there and went psycho on Liz, screaming, yelling, F-bombing her. It was terrible. It was absolutely terrible. After that, she was finished. Liz left the bathroom and came over to me, and she's like, told me what happened. And she's like, I've seen the wild monkey. I never thought I would see this, but yeah, you need to go talk to her husband. So I went over to him. He was standing in the doorway, and I said, we need to step outside for a minute. So we went outside the building, and I said, hey, look, Ronnie, it's pretty simple. You know, you need to confront your wife and tell her what she did was totally inappropriate, really sinful, and her mouth, all the garbage that came out, is unbelievable. We have now seen the wild monkey, and yeah, I believe you now, and you as the husband need to address her, or we can't be friends. Guess what he didn't do? Never addressed her. It's been 35 years, and he's never addressed her. And that unfortunately ended that friendship. It was painful. Ever had this happen to you? You lost a friend? It's painful losing a friend. Never saw it coming. One thing triggered her, and then that was the end of that. Once a vibrant relationship absolutely vaporized. Fast forward a couple of years. Liz lost her twin sister when she was 33, left behind two little girls under 3 years old who, you know, don't remember mom, basically. And So this friend of ours, Stacy, became like Liz's replacement for her twin sister because they looked alike, about the same height, etc. So Liz had a deep bond with this with our friend, and so wanted to repair their relationship. And so Liz actually went to her at one time and said, "I don't know what I did. I mean, I just didn't save you a seat. We never agreed to that. But if I did anything to offend you, I apologize. And can we be friends? And I'm just sorry for whatever I might have done." And her friend looked at her and said, "That wasn't hard, was it?" Yeah, yeah. Good or bad? Bad. That's bad. So we realized, okay, she has no interest in confessing her sin at all. And so we got to pull away from them. And we didn't see them for a long time. Well, fast forward, a couple of years went by. And our friend, Stacy's sister, died in a car wreck by my house. Solo car wreck, very tragic. She died. So we reached out to them because Liz understood what it was like to lose a sister, a twin sister, and reached out to her, sent a message saying, "We understand your pain, etc." And we eventually found out through the grapevine that there was a pub in town where they're having like an 80s band. We all liked Journey and Foreigner, you know, all those groups. And so they let us know that our friend Stacy wanted us to come to the dinner because she needed to talk to us and kind of set things straight. And we're like, fantastic. But things had been so unpredictable with the wild monkey. We're like, should we go? Should we not go? So we decided to take the higher road and go. So we went. But we had this one caveat, a little test. The test was this. If she's serious about being friends, we're not going to go talk to her. She needs to come from her table and talk to us. That's what we did. So we showed up at the restaurant, and it was awkward. Because we could see them, they could see us, and she never moved the whole evening. No, was not interested at all. And so we realized that night that we thought the door was open to reclaim the friendship. Oh, no, the door was closed as tight as ever. And we don't know why she sent us word to show up because she wouldn't even talk to us. And so that was the end of that friendship. So I just prayed for them last week. It's been 35 years. Basically, my prayer was, God, work in their life to wake them up. Because we talked about it last night after our anniversary dinner. If they were to call us and say they were sorry, we would absolutely forgive them. Or forgive her and restore the friendship. But they're not interested. She's not interested. You ever had that happen to you? Why am I talking about that? Because that's what chapter 20 is about. David had a friend, and his friend was Saul. And Saul loved David. David was a great warrior. He'd killed Goliath. He was a good friend to Saul. Saul loved his harp playing, loved his music. And all of a sudden, after he killed Goliath and came into town, all the young ladies started singing that song. Remember the song? You know? And that one song triggered Saul. He became the wild monkey. And all of a sudden, that relationship they had with David was totally over. And David is crushed by the fact that the king, for no reason, hates him and wants to actually kill him. But David, in his heart, just like us, still has a place for that friend and wants the door to open to rebuild that relationship. And that's what happens in chapter 20. There's a door that opens, and David gets the opportunity to see, does Saul really want to be friends or does he not want to be friends? But I'll seize the opportunity. So if you have a fractured relationship right now in your family, we do. With friends, yeah, we do. What can you do to rebuild that? We'll learn from David what he's going to attempt. It starts with what I call the dilemma in verses 1 to 4. There's a dilemma. It says, David fled from Naoth in Ramah and came to Jonathan, who's probably in Jerusalem. And he says to his best friend, after his dad just tried to kill him in the last chapter, remember, he sent out three groups of men to kill David, and they all started prophesying uncontrollably. And then Saul says in the last chapter, I'll do it myself. He shows up. What happened to him? He starts prophesying. Can't control himself, rips his clothes off, throws himself down in front of the prophet, and he can't eliminate David because he can't control his body because God has control of him. And so David shows up to Jonathan and says all the logical questions like, what did I do to trigger you? What is my iniquity? I mean, like, what did I do at the dinner? I didn't save you a seat. Big deal. You'll come over our house Friday night for dinner. Who cares? Etc. And what is my sin before your father? That he's seeking to kill me. I didn't do anything. So he's talking to Jonathan, trying to get off his chest. And Jonathan tells him in verse 2, he says to him, hey, far from it. You shall not die. Cool it. Don't worry. You're not going to die. Behold, my father does nothing, either great or small, without disclosing it to me. So why should my father hide this thing from me about killing you? It's not so. Now Jonathan illustrates here that he doesn't have intel on what his dad just did in the previous chapter. He didn't know about that. His dad traveled there to kill David. He didn't know that yet. But he's telling him, my dad's not going to make a strategic move like eliminating you unless he tells me. How does David respond to that word of comfort? Verse 3, the dilemma ensues. Yet David vowed again, saying, your father knows well that I have found favor in your sight, and he has said, do not let Jonathan know this, lest he be grieved. But truly as the Lord lives and as your soul lives, there is hardly a step between me and death. He says, look, Jonathan, wake up. I mean, smell the coffee. I mean, I can't even take a step without thinking it could be my last one because your dad's trying to kill me. Jonathan then says to David, this is really interesting. This is a good friend right here. He tells him, whatever you say, I will do for you. Whatever you say, I'll do for you. This is the king's son. He has tons of connections, tons of power. And he says, look, David, I mean, I'll step into this broken, fractured relationship. I'll do anything that I need to do to make it right. Well, that leads to what we call the deal, or like the test. So if you have that fractured relationship, you come up with some kind of test to determine, is it possible for you to reclaim the friendship? I mean, what can you do? So that's what they're going to do. David's going to initiate it. Verse 5, David says to Jonathan, behold, tomorrow is the new moon, and I ought to sit down to eat with the king, because he's on his staff, as it were. But let me go, that I might hide myself in a field until the third evening of the new moon feast. And if your father misses me at all, because he's supposed to be at the table enjoying the dinner and the festivities, if he misses me, then say, David earnestly asked leave to me to run to Bethlehem, his city, because it is a yearly sacrifice there for the whole family. And if he says, it is good that he did this, your servant shall be safe. But if he's angry, I mean, he goes wild monkey on you, well, then he's decided on evil. So it's a test. It's very interesting. The Israelites offered burnt offering sacrifices, according to Numbers 28:14, and Numbers 10:10, for the new moon. They would offer burnt sacrifice and worship God for the new moon that would bring new harvest and everything. And according to David's situation as a soldier in Saul's military, he's the guy who took out Goliath. So he should be at this dinner at the king's house, but he's not going to show up. Why not? Would you show up to somebody who has a tendency to throw javelins at you? Probably not. And it's your father-in-law. Unbelievably messed up, dysfunctional family. We have none of those in our church. Every family is totally functional here. Yeah, messed up family. And so Saul, David's probably thinking, I got word that Saul became a prophet. And so did his emissaries that were sent to kill me. Maybe he has a heart change. Maybe we could be friends again. That's what David's thinking, had to be thinking. So he sets up this test. The only thing about the test is you have to ask yourself, on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 is totally truthful, 0 it's not. Is it true? And it's not true. It's true there's a new moon feast. There's nothing about his father missing him. He's concocting this whole scenario up on his own. Now, you might say, why didn't he just tell the truth? Well, he's not telling the truth because multiple times Saul has tried to kill him. Remember how he tried to kill him? First I'll throw a javelin at you. Oh, I missed. Okay, well then marry my oldest daughter, but you can't marry until you pay the dowry. What's the dowry? You have to go to battle to fight the Philistines, X amount of battles, and if you live, then you can have her. Oh, that's great. I don't want her. Well, my second daughter wants to marry you. What's the dowry? 100 foreskins of 100 dead Philistines. I'll bring you 200. And he did it, and he didn't die. And he continued. Oh, then he sent the three teams out to eliminate David. That didn't work. So then Saul came himself. So you could say there's probably good reason why David doesn't want to show up at the dinner. He might die at the dinner, all right, with this guy that goes wild monkey on him. And so he uses what I used last week. I told you about graded, G-R-A-D-E-D, absolutism, which says there's absolutes in the cosmos. Right? Even the statement there's absolutes in the cosmos is an absolute. And so there's absolutes in the cosmos, moral behavior, and some moral behavior has more importance to it than other moral behavior. And we talked about this all last week. So like the Hebrew midwives said, when Pharaoh told them, kill every male Hebrew baby that you see, what'd they do? They said, no, we're going to save every Hebrew male baby. And they did. And they lied to Pharaoh's face, and God then rewards them for their deception. Why? On moral absolutism, you grade the absolutes and say, this saving the life of a baby? Well, I can deceive to save that life, and God will understand this because I need to save the life. Saving the life was more important. So David's using, not that he knew what graded absolutism is, but that's what he's doing. It's important for me to save my life. God has chosen me to be the anointed. So they come up with this little test. David could rightfully ask Jonathan to go to his dangerous father because they had made a deal as friends. Verse 8. Therefore, David says, kindly deal with your servant. Know the humble language he uses to Jonathan, the king's son. For you have brought your servant into a covenant of the Lord with you. They made a covenant deal. To make a covenant, in the Hebrew word, it means to cut something, make a deal. You signed a deal that we'd be best friends for life. He says, but if there's iniquity in me, I mean, if I've blown it, and it wasn't your dad's fault, put me to death yourself. For why then should you bring me to your father? So David says, I think I'm innocent, but if I've done anything wrong, sinful, just eliminate me and your father's okay, but it's really the other way around. Jonathan would have none of that talk from his friend. Verse 9, Jonathan says, far be it from you, for if I should indeed learn that evil has been decided by my father to come to you, wouldn't I tell you about it? Isn't that the truth? If you found out somebody wanted to take out your best friend, wouldn't you text them? Joe is after you. You know, wouldn't you call him? Yeah, situation at work. I just got word. They're out to take you out. I mean, you tell him. He says, you can count on me to tell you I'm your best friend. Verse 10, David then said to Jonathan, who will tell me if your father answers you harshly? And Jonathan said to David, come and let us go out into the field. So both of them went out into the field. Why? They're talking about strategy of this test to find out, will Saul be a friend or will Saul not be a friend? And they don't stick around in town to talk about it. Why? Saul has spies. Today we have drones, phones that listen to you, that type of thing. Back in the day, they just went out into a field and had a discussion. And so they want to talk about the specifics of the test to see if they can restore the relationship. Verse 12. Then Jonathan said to David, the Lord, the God of Israel, he's going to be the witness. When I have sounded out my father about this time tomorrow or the third day of this feast, behold, if there is a good feeling toward David, shall I not send to you a word to make known? And if it please my father to do you harm, may the Lord do so to Jonathan and more also. If I don't make it known to you and send you away, that you may go in safety, and may the Lord be with you as he has been with my father. So he said, you could count on me. We're going to do this test, and I'll get word to you through somebody, some emissary. My dad's either wants to rebuild the friendship, or he wants to eliminate you. And then he says in verse 14, something very interesting. He says to David, he's the king's son speaking, and after I meet with my dad, if I am what? Still alive. Why does he say that? Well, because his dad can go crazy. He says, if I'm still alive, will you not show me loving kindness of the Lord that I might not die? The word loving kindness is the word chesed. You say it kind of like you're going to spit, chesed, because there's two H's in Hebrew. There's a huh and there's a ch. And you stand in class with a whole group of students making these sounds. It's totally hilarious. The professor, everybody go huh, huh. And then everybody go huh, huh. And it's like, hey, you're spitting on me, dude. I mean, yeah, it's that word. It's chesed. What's that word mean? Loving kindness that cannot be broken. It's the love that God has for his people. This is why I believe in eternal security. Once you're saved, you're always saved. Why? God's love is chesed, loyal to his children, no matter what. He says, well, if I'm alive, can you still show loving kindness to me? Like when you become the king? And then he tacks in verse 15. He says, you shall not be cut off. You shall not cut off your chesed, your loving kindness, from my house, my dynasty, forever. Not even when the Lord cuts off every one of the enemies of David from the face of the earth. What did he just ask him? He says, when you become the anointed king, not me, when God makes you the king as he promised you would be, will you remember not to eliminate my family line? Now, when we have a presidential election here, we vote in the next president, right? and they assume office, and all their people populate all the offices, and all the other people lose their jobs. And you know how this goes? I mean, yeah, we've seen it all happen here. And but we don't like vote the new guy in, and then he doesn't turn around and kill everybody else in that family line. That's what they did, because this was a theocracy set up to rule by, you know, iron-fisted power is how they had it set up. And that's what they did in the ancient times. So he tells David, when you become the king, will you show mercy to my family and not do what they usually do? You know, if you fast forward, Jonathan did have a son. Remember his name? This is Bible Trivia 101. Mephibosheth. There's a name for your next child. Mephibosheth. Try spelling it. He had, what was his problem? He was handicapped. He was lame. Walking was an issue. And who's going to show him mercy? David. David's going to show him mercy. But it would probably take us 3 or 4 years to get to that story, so I just had to fast forward. Anyway. Now, with these formalities in place, Jonathan is going to set up as a military man the strategy of what they're going to do exactly. This test to see whether Saul will be a friend or be a foe. Verse 18, Jonathan said to him, tomorrow is the new moon, and you will be missed because your seat will be empty at my dad's table, you know. And when you have stayed for 3 days, you shall go down quickly and come to the place where you hid yourself on that eventful day, and you shall remain by the stone of Ezel. So there's lots of rocks and stones in Israel. It's very mountainous. So they obviously knew where this big giant stone was. Go hide there by that massive stone. And I will shoot 3 arrows to the side, though I was shooting at a target. And behold, I will send the lad, who is my armor bearer, saying, go find the arrows. If I specifically say to the lad, behold, the arrows are on this side, go get them, then that's a sign for you to come. For there is safety for you and no harm as the Lord lives. But on the contrary, if I say to the youth, behold, the arrows are beyond you, then you, David, go, for the Lord has sent you away. My dad's ticked. He's crazy. He's gone wild monkey. Run. I'm adding to the text. It's not in there if you're reading. As for the agreement which you and I have spoken of, behold, the Lord is between me and you forever. We are friends forever. I will not desert you. I'll always be loyal to you. I will make sure you know whether my dad wants to kill you or whether he wants to actually talk to you and rebuild a relationship. What did David do? Verse 24 says, David hid in the field. And when the new moon came, the king sat down to eat food. What happened? Well, we have the discovery, as we found at that pub that night when I had our little test. Does Stacy want to rebuild a relationship or does she want to blow up the relationship? Well, discovery time, verse 25. The king set at his seat as usual, and the seat by the wall. Then Jonathan arose up, and Abner, the head of the military, sat down by Saul's side, but David's place was empty. Everybody could see there's someone not here. David, where is he? First, we must analyze, because it's a military church. Why did the king sit by the wall? All military people and CIA people and DIA people who won't tell you that where they work, but I know you. Because I've gone to dinner with you before. And I can tell you how it is when you go out to CIA, when you go out to dinner with them. I can tell you how it goes. They pick the table. Serious, they do. First time it happened to me, I'm like, what are we doing? You know, it's like stewardess was like, here's your table, not ours. I want the table over there. Why that table? We want that table. It's because it, why? I can tell you why, because I asked the question at dinner. Why are we sitting over here? Well, I can see all the exits. I can see all the doors. I can see if anybody's coming at me. I got time to move and get out of the building. What about us? You're on your own. I've gone on vacation with people who do special ops stuff. And the same thing on vacation. You know, my enemies pursue me in the country. My enemies pursue me outside the country. I've got used to we're against the wall thing, looking at all entrances and exits, right? Am I wrong? I don't think so. That's why he's sitting there. He's got a head of the military to him, next to him, across the table is Jonathan. Hey, we're missing somebody. David, wonder where he is. That's why he's sitting there. It says in verse 26, nevertheless, Saul did not speak anything that day, the first day of the feast, for he thought, quote, it's an accident. David's not here. He's not clean. Surely he's not clean. He's not talking about a bath or a shower. Ritually unclean. Your favorite book in the Old Testament is probably Leviticus, I would assume. Yeah. I took it my senior year at Dallas Seminary as a Hebrew exegetical class. It was most exciting. A teacher from Cambridge taught us. It was awesome. I mean, it really was. But chapters 11 to 15 tell you all the ways that you can get unclean. Like, don't touch something dead. Well, I can't mow the yard until I move that dead possum. Don't touch it. You touch it, you're unclean. There's lots of ways to get unclean. So Saul's thinking, David is not here because something happened ritually and he's unclean, so he's not here. I just find this really interesting. Saul's not too swift because envy and jealousy has clouded his thinking. He's not thinking straight. He should have been thinking, David is not here because, oh, let's see, I threw a javelin at him. Hello. Tried to get him to marry my first daughter to get him killed, but going on a battlefield, that didn't work. So he married the second daughter. Yeah, 200 foreskins. He didn't die. Then I sent out emissaries to kill him. That didn't work. I went out to kill him. That didn't work. He should have been thinking like that. But jealousy and envy clouds your thinking. Like when Liz tells our friend, you know, if I did anything that was wrong, and I apologize, and the friend looks at her and says, that wasn't hard, was it? What was her problem? Well, pride and jealousy and envy cloud your thinking. And so that is what's going on in this particular passage. So it came about the next day, the second day of the new moon, that David's place was empty. Now it's looking uncomfortable. So Saul said to Jonathan, his son, why has the son of Jesse not come to the meal, either yesterday or today? Where is this guy? Now, what you need to pay attention to is, what's missing in that verse? Something huge is missing in that verse. The name of David. He didn't even use his name. Why? He can't stand him. He's like, I'm not even going to say his name at my table. Where is the son of Jesse? Jonathan steps in and notice what he says to help cover for David. Jonathan then answered Saul and says, David earnestly asked leave of me to go to Bethlehem. For he said, please let me go since our family has a sacrifice in the city and my brother has commanded me to attend. And now if I have found favor in your sight, please let me get away that I might see my brothers. For this reason, he's not come to the king's table. Was that a true statement? No. He took what David said, which was partial truth, not truth, and he embellishes it. The brother had never said anything. So he takes it to a whole nother level. They should have just said the truth, right? But they didn't. This is graded absolutism. He wants to cover for his son, his friend David, so he doesn't get killed. And so he doesn't tell his dad the exact truth to spare David's life. Verse 30, how did Saul treat this information? This is the wild monkey. Saul's anger, what? Burned, I mean, instantly against Jonathan. He said to him, notice what he says to his son. You son of a perverse, rebellious woman. Wow. Do I not know that you are choosing the son of Jesse to your own shame and the shame of your mother's nakedness like when she had you? For as long as he is the son of Jesse lives on earth, neither you nor your kingdom will be established. Therefore now send and bring him to me. I need to kill this guy. Because son, you can't be the king unless I take him out. See the arrogance of this man? See, jealousy and envy absolutely blinded him to his pride. The thing that's most interesting is who's really the perverse, rebellious person? Saul. He just won't look at himself. He's really the problem. It wasn't his wife. Jesus talked about this in Matthew 7. When you go apoplectic like this and all this garbage comes out of your mouth. Jesus talked about this in Matthew 7. And what did he say? He says, for from within people in your heart, from their hearts, when they start talking, come on. Evil thoughts, unchastity, theft, murder, adultery, greed, malice, deceit, licentiousness, what? Envy. Blasphemy, the Greek word is blasphemeo, means to say hurtful, mean, cutting things. Like, it didn't hurt to apologize, did it? That's blasphemeo. Arrogance, son, you could still become the king. I don't care what God has said, I'm going to make you the king. Total arrogance. And folly. See, when you start talking like that, you just show what was in your heart. Still true today? Unfortunately. So it doesn't matter if you're on a football team, you teach a class, you're a student, you're a politician, whatever. You start talking like this, as all this stuff starts coming out, it's just telling everybody around you what's really in your heart. And you really need a relationship with God. That's what you need. Clean your heart up. So Saul finishes his evil tirade, and Jonathan then bravely tells his dad in verse 32, but Jonathan answered Saul, his father, and said to him, this is totally brave for him to say this. Why should he, David, be put to death? Come on, Dad. What has he done? The guy is innocent, and you're trying to kill him. his friend stood his ground. How did his father respond? Verse 33. Well, it says in verse 33, he did what? He's always got a spear near him. Don't talk to people who carry javelins and stuff. Saul then hurled his what? Spear at him to strike him down. So Jonathan connected the dots, and he knew that his father had decided to put David to death. They had the test. Rebuild the friendship, destroy the friendship. He now knew, my dad has no intention of ever being your friend again, David, because he just threw a spear at me, his own son. Won't jealousy and envy lead you down paths you never thought you'd walk down? Sad, tragic. This leads to what we would call the disclosure in verse 35 and following. It said it came about in the morning. Jonathan went out into the field, according to their little plan, with an appointment with David, and a little lad was with him, his armor bearer. And he said to him, hey, run, find now the arrows which I'm about to shoot. The lad was running, and he shot an arrow past him. When the lad reached the place of the arrow which Jonathan had shot, Jonathan called after the lad, and he said, is not the arrow beyond you? What did he just tell David? You better start running. Get out of Dodge. And Jonathan called after the lad and said, hurry, be quick, do not stay. And Jonathan's lad picked up the arrow and came to his master. But the lad was not aware of anything. He wasn't privy to what the test. Only Jonathan and David knew about the matter. Then Jonathan gave his weapons to his lad and said to him, go bring them to the city. And when the lad was gone, David rose from the south side of that rock and fell on his face to the ground. It is interesting. He bows three times before the king's son, even though he's going to be the king. And then what happened? Well, they kissed each other as friends in a Middle Eastern way. And then they, both grown warriors, started crying. It says they wept. But then it says what? David, he cried more. He cried more. You have to ask yourself, why were they crying? I'll tell you why I think they were crying. They both, these hardened warriors, they wept on each other's shoulders because they realized now that their friendship was going to be extremely complicated, not simple. They wept because they had seen the wild monkey and realized it was not going to be tamed when the door was open. They wept because they knew that it would be hard to be close friends while David was on the run constantly. And they wept because of, well, what their friendship could have been. I've been there before emotionally with our friends, what it could have been. Why did David cry more? David wept more, I think, because he realized that the path that God ordained for him to be the king was not going to be simple, but difficult. He wept more because he would be on the run from a bloodthirsty man that had a lot of power to make his life miserable. He wept more because he realized he would not have a really close relationship with his wife, Michal. And he wept because he was unfairly and unjustly treated by Saul. He was an innocent man. And so he cried more. When your heart is broken like that over a friend, what do you need? You need a friend. And that's how the passage ends. I call it the dedication, where one friend, Jonathan, steps up to the other friend, David, and consoles him. Notice what he tells him. Jonathan said to David, go in safety, since we have sworn to each other in the name of the Lord, saying, the Lord will be between me and you, between my descendants and your descendants forever. Then he arose and departed while Jonathan went into the city. Jonathan was the class act. They're crying, and he tells his friend, I will always be your friend. There's always a place at my table for you. I will always protect you. As long as I live, we are friends, and friends indeed. He consoled his friend. When I lost the other friend, the other two friends, when we lost them, it was very painful. But God sent us two other friends that became even greater friends. This is my friend Rick Seeley. He's now with the Lord. I think he died when he was 56 from cancer. He died right before I came here. He was head of homicide. I was the chaplain for 1,300 officers under him. His wife Denise, great people. And God says, I closed the door on this friendship, but I'm going to open a door for another friendship. You tried to fix this one, but I'm going to give you some amazing friends. I pray that for you. If you present that little test to fix something in a testy time, and you propose a test and it goes south on you and God closes the door, well, then realize, pull back, but then be praying for who God's going to bring into your life, because he's always going to send you a Rick and a Denise, because we all need friends like that. But our responsibility is to try to fix the fractured relationship first.